From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer have called for the removal of President Donald Trump from office through the 25th Amendment, a day after a violent mob of his supporters rioted their way into the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. Ms. Pelosi announced the dramatic step on Thursday, saying, quote, "I join the Senate Democratic leader in calling on the vice president to remove this president by immediately invoking the 25th Amendment. If the vice president and cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment." Lawmakers worked late into the early hours of Thursday to certify the Electoral College win of Joe Biden after the Senate chamber invasion interrupted them. My guest is Mitch Jezrich, Pacifica reporter, host of Letters on Politics, heard on KPFA and KPFK. He covered the congressional certification of Biden's win this week. He's also a veteran journalist on D.C. politics and had spent years in D.C. as well, frequenting the Capitol building, in fact. Welcome to the program, Mitch.
Very good to be here, Sonali. Thank you.
So first, let's talk about what we're seeing on Thursday with the call by Pelosi and Schumer to invoke the 25th Amendment. For years, we've had calls by, you know, outsiders, non-lawmakers, saying that Trump is so unhinged that Pence should use the 25th Amendment to remove him. How unprecedented is it in history to now see lawmakers, not to mention top lawmakers, calling for the removal of the president?
I don't think most people even knew what the 25th Amendment to the United States Constitution was before Donald Trump became president.
Right.
So I suspect that is, you know, as unprecedented as it is. I should probably qualify that a little bit, because the 25th Amendment is actually a pretty large amendment with four different parts of it. And it was adopted in the late 1960s after the assassination, which happened in the early 60s, of John F. Kennedy, just to make sure that we had a clear idea how a succession of power should occur if a president dies. We always knew it was a vice president, but there was some ambiguity actually in the Constitution. So it helps lay out that, you know, what happens if a president were to die. And then the fourth part of this amendment, and the last part of the amendment, is specifically what you are talking about. And that was usually seen as if the president becomes incapacitated in some manner or is just unable to fulfill the duties of the job. I have never heard before Donald Trump anyone ever bring up this idea of using the 25th Amendment to remove a living president. And we did start to hear it with the Trump presidency, and now we're hearing it from the top lawmakers on Capitol Hill, especially from Democrats. There are even some Republicans who have expressed support, or at least expressed the idea that Donald Trump perhaps should not fulfill his final, you know, a couple of weeks here in office. And so, you know, we'll have to see what happens. The way this would have to work is Mike Pence would have to initiate using Section 4 of the 25th Amendment, and he would need a majority of Donald Trump's cabinet to also support it. And then he would go to both Nancy Pelosi and right now Mitch McConnell. But depending on whenever the two Georgia senators who won their election this week are sworn in, it could, you know, conceivably it'll probably be Chuck Schumer before the end of Trump's term ends. So it could be going both to Pelosi and Schumer with a letter saying that we're going to invoke the 25th Amendment of the Constitution to remove the president. If that were to occur, then Donald Trump would have the right to contest it, but then they could try to expedite that process. And in the end, for it to be successful, and again, this is not expected. I don't expect this actually to happen. I'm not sure Mike Pence will do this. I'm not sure there's a majority in the cabinet that would agree to do this. But you never know. I don't know that for sure.
Well, some have suggested that, and you know, Pelosi is essentially threatened that they will move forward with impeachment if the 25th Amendment is not invoked. And Ilhan Omar has already begun drawing articles of impeachment. And I wonder if impeachment wouldn't be a better strategy if one's goal is to deter Trumpism for the long haul? Because I understand that if he is impeached and convicted by the Senate, it actually disqualifies him from ever holding federal office again. He's already announced he wants to run in 2024.
Yeah, I think the same obstacle kind of exists both for invoking the 25th Amendment to the Constitution and impeaching and convicting the president. And what that is, the final step of being able to use the 25th Amendment to the Constitution is you need two-thirds of the Congress to vote for it. You need a supermajority. So not only do you need Mike Pence, a majority of the cabinet, you also need a supermajority of Congress to vote for it in order to remove Donald Trump from office using the 25th Amendment to the Constitution. So as you correctly indicated, Nancy Pelosi said, Chuck Schumer supports this as well, that if they do not move on the 25th Amendment, then that they would move, that Pelosi would move on articles of impeachment. Now, Nancy Pelosi can impeach Donald Trump tomorrow if she chose to do so. You don't have to, like we had a year ago, have all of these hearings. You don't have to have an investigation. That actually doesn't have to happen. That is not in the Constitution. They are not beholden to do that. She could just bring articles of impeachment to the floor, whether they be from Ilhan Omar or someone else, and they can have an up and down vote, up or down vote on it at that moment. And you only need a majority. And if that were if they had the majority and if they were to pass the articles of impeachment, well, Donald Trump would become the first president in U.S. history to actually be impeached twice. Mm-hmm. Where it gets sticky is what happens in the Senate, because it's not so clear whether the Senate would have the same ability to move as quickly as the House potentially could, because it does suggest in the Constitution that the president would be tried and that he would be judged by a jury, which is the Senate. And we will remember last year in the Senate trial, Mitch McConnell floated the idea before the trial happened of not having a trial at all, but instead saying, I'm just going to have a guilty or not guilty vote right from the get-go, and we're just not even going to have the trial. That caused concern and outrage, but that also was questionable legally speaking, if he could do that. So they ended up having the trial. So I think that will be the complicated thing, is if they could actually get a trial in and done before the term ends. And maybe they could. I'm not saying they couldn't. Maybe they could. But after that, once again, just like you would need for the 25th Amendment in the Senate, you would need a supermajority of the senators to vote to convict the president in order to remove him from office. So, you know, it's tough work ahead
to make that happen. Lawmakers from both parties have done, it seems, far too little to address Trump and his violence for these past 4 years. It would be an easy case to make that they have let him off the hook and enabled him to foment the violence that took place on Wednesday. And on Wednesday night, it seems when lawmakers themselves, even those who have supported Trump so loyally, when they were faced with their own, you know, with danger to their own person, seemed pretty shaken. Let's talk about the certification process that was interrupted on Wednesday, but then resumed late Wednesday and went into the early hours of Thursday. What did you hear from, you know, folks like Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has been one of Trump's strongest enablers, certainly in the Senate, his strongest enabler?
Well, Mitch McConnell, and I would have to say before the barbarians stormed the gates, If I could say that, that was wrong, you'll forgive me. But before they stormed the Capitol, Mitch McConnell had actually already denounced on the Senate floor the attempt by a dozen Senate Republicans or so to try to throw out the slate of electors from the state of Arizona. And that's what they were in the middle of debating when the Capitol was stormed by Trump supporters. And he gave a very strong speech, actually saying that this was a fool's errand. Those are my words, not his, but that this was not the right path to go down. And of course, he kept that tenor many hours later, when the Senate finally came back after they cleared the Capitol and things had calmed down, and they resumed the process of certifying the Electoral College vote. So, you know, that was Mitch McConnell. But I think what might have even been more interesting, when they came back after the melee occurred on the Capitol, is what happened in the House of Representatives. Now, in the Senate, again, there was about a dozen Republicans who were going to challenge, who said that they would be challenging the slate of electors from a number of states. That shrunk after the melee occurred to six, right? There were still six Republicans in the Senate who voted to throw out the Electoral College votes for Arizona and for Pennsylvania, but it shrunk.
Ted Cruz, House. Josh Hawley were the two leaders, Tommy Tuberville as well, and the three others. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. And Tuberville just replaced Doug Jones. So replacing a Democrat with a Democrat with a Republican there from Alabama. But in the House of Representatives, it was a very different scene, especially even if you're just listening to the debate. If you're listening to the debate in the Senate, it was very somber. We got to come together. This could never happen again. In the House, Republicans were very impassioned still about this allegation that the election was rigged in favor of Joe Biden over Donald Trump. And you had really
so there's a much stronger allegiance to Trump in the House.
Yeah, there was that was on full display on Wednesday night. And finally, when they went to vote on I was watching specifically for Pennsylvania, and this was late at night, early morning, East Coast time, when they went to vote whether or not to throw out the slate of electors for the state of Pennsylvania, 70% of the Republicans still voted to do that, still voted to try
shocking,
to disqualify
quite shocking. Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. I was surprised to see, after everything that occurred, still 70% voted for it. And that's significant. Because that's going to, I think that is going to, I think everyone, after what happened, pretty shocked about what happened. I know why I was. And I think everyone's still trying to find their talking points, their intellectual framework to be able to talk about what happened. That goes for Democrats. It goes for Republicans. That goes for Fox News, which I do watch a bit of, because I think it's important to know what they're saying. And I do think the fact that there were some 70%, maybe just a little under 70% of Republicans who voted to throw out Pennsylvania's Electoral College votes is going to lead to a dynamic in which they're going to be able to sort of rebound and still be able to try to make this case and try to that the election was stolen and try to make it appear as though the Joe Biden presidency is an illegitimate one.
So when we look at the denunciations against what Trump fomented, just to get into the weeds of how they spoke on Wednesday night, did you have, I mean, of course, the Democrats very clearly linked Trump's words, Trump himself, to the Capitol building invasion and the mob. Many Republicans, I understand, denounced the violence, but did they blame Trump for it, or did they dance around that? Because many have just been dancing around Trump's culpability for 4 years now. Even when journalists have confronted them with Trump's violent words, many have simply said, oh, I don't know about that, I haven't heard about it, or are simply silent. So what did they say on Wednesday night? Did they link Trump explicitly to what happened?
Some have. There's 535 members on Congress, so I'm not entirely sure about what everyone has said. But my sense, Lindsey Graham said Trump was partially responsible. So that, you know, it's not a full embrace of this is on Trump, but probably more than others would have been willing to say. Some of the Republicans have blamed Trump. There are Republicans in Congress that have suggested that Trump should not remain in office until the end of his term. But in listening to the debate that was happening in the House, I think nobody was excusing what happened on the Capitol, right? Because that would be
right.
Political.
You can't do that openly.
You can't do that. Unless you want to stand out, you know, but I think what they were trying to do in their argument was delinking the issue of storming the Capitol to the issue of their allegations that that there was election fraud and that the election was stolen. So they were trying to say one does not equal two, right?
In fact, when in fact, of course, the mob was very clearly motivated by precisely that, which is why they gathered at the nation's capital on Tuesday and Wednesday, and answered Trump's call. I mean, he literally tweeted in December for people to come to D.C. on December. On January 6th, saying it will be wild, and then addressed them in person on Wednesday at a podium on the Ellipse and said that he would lead a march down Pennsylvania Avenue while saying all along that the election was stolen from him and that he won by a landslide. So he has explicitly linked those two over and over again. It just seems that any lawmakers who refuse that link are I don't know, on something.
Well, you know, what really stood out, what I keep thinking about, Sonali, is I remember watching Trump's appearance at a rally in Georgia on Monday, just before the runoff election was to occur. And he was on stage with Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler, who actually reversed her vote on Wednesday night.
She was one of the 12, right?
Happened. Yeah, she was one of the 12.
She made a very short statement.
yeah, she did, about why she's doing it. But what I remember from Trump's speech that night was him saying specifically, wait to see what happens on Wednesday. It's going to be like something, I'm paraphrasing here, but it's going to be like something you've never seen before. Wait until you see what happens. And then Kelly Loeffler gets up there and says to the crowd, I want you to know I will be there on Wednesday and I will be voting to reject these electoral college votes from these states. So, and then this address or the appearance that Trump made at the beginning of Wednesday's rally in the morning outside of the White House. That was an incredibly incendiary speech, but perhaps even more incendiary than Trump's speech was Rudy Giuliani's speech that he gave at the White House, where he was really encouraging people basically to go to battle. And I think that's been overshadowed a little bit, which often occurs when you're right next to the president.
So here we have a situation where Trump still is in office for two more weeks. He released a statement through Dan Scavino because he was kicked off of Twitter for 12 hours, saying that, first of all, repeating the lies around the stolen election, and then saying that there will be an orderly transition on January 20th. Is that a big deal? Do you get the sense in any way that indicates he might have been chastened by what happened?
It's hard to know because we're not really hearing from Donald Trump. We're really seeing and feeling and experiencing right now the power of Twitter. This morning I got up, I'm like, so what's Trump saying this morning? Oh, there's nothing here. We really haven't heard from Donald Trump other than what his surrogates are putting out there. And it's not entirely clear if those are Donald Trump's words, right? Now, they may be. I have no proof that they're not. But it's not really clear if those are his words or if those are his sentiments or not. And we know that Donald Trump's temperament can change dramatically from day to day. And so I don't know how you could not be shaken by what happened. Most people were shaken by what happened. People like you and me, Sonali, that are 3,000 miles away. But that said,
these stories and shouldn't, you know, and who saw it coming, we're still shaken.
I think everybody was shaken. I think everybody was pretty shocked by it. So I don't know. But Donald Trump, I don't know. I think he would be shaken by what happened, but I actually don't know that for sure. He has definitely.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Mitch. You have worked in Washington, D.C. for years at Pacifica Station WPFW. When you were covering, in person, the proceedings of Capitol Hill, when you were covering what lawmakers were doing, I imagine that you were in and out of that building, the Capitol building, the Senate chamber, possibly House chamber, I'm sure, quite often. What was it like for you to sit 3,000 miles away and see this being overrun by, seeing this mob break the windows, scale the walls, vandalize and walk off with podiums and scribble on the walls?
I mean, let's be honest. There are people on the left that have been dreaming about storming the Capitol themselves, right? So,
for very different reasons.
The politics are different, but, I guess for me, the Capitol building actually is maybe my favorite building I've ever in the world to me. And not because of its symbolism, actually, not because of American power or American exceptionalism, or even because they call it the People's House, as they tend to do. But it's a huge museum, and it's a working museum in which history is still being made at that time. And, you know, I remember when I had the press pass, which was like gold, I had access to the Capitol any time of the day or night, any day of the week, and I could be in there by myself. No, I was never quite by myself. I was on some, you know, TV system somewhere being watched by security, but you felt like you were by yourself. And I used to love just roaming the halls and, you know, thinking about the history and looking at the things. But what's you really notice is the change in politics that have occurred since I was there. I left DC 15 years ago. You would go to a rally 15 years ago, and what it really was a press conference disguised as a rally, usually by an organization, a nonprofit, or by lawmakers themselves. But it was never really like this genuine organic rally that was happening. And even when you had the big rallies in Washington, DC, you know, it was almost like a vacation field trip. You know, we're coming to our nation's capital. Yeah, we're here to rally, but let's go see the Washington Monument, or, you know, let's go to the Smithsonian Museums. You know, it always kind of had that feel. And I think what we've seen in more recent years, these pitch battles, is something that when I was in DC, I had never seen before.
Right. I mean, indeed. Journalists working that area now, I imagine, do feel like they're risking their lives. Well, I want to thank you so much, Mitch, as always, for your incredible work. I know people can follow you on Facebook, as well as, of course, tune into your show, Letters and Politics, on KPFA and KPFA. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Mitch Jezrich, Pacifica reporter, host of Letters and Politics, heard on KPFA and KPFK. He's covered the congressional certification of Joe Biden's win this week, and a veteran journalist on DC politics. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.